White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders has reaffirmed that the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump is indeed looking into sending migrants from the southern border to sanctuary cities spread across the United States. Sanders appeared on ABC's This Week.
We have a massive number of people that are already here. We need to take away some of that burden on all of the communities that are along the border, like San Diego and El Paso, and look at other options. Again, not our first choice. Ideally, Congress would fix the problem.
And Sanders said there is a simple solution to the border problems.
The ideal solution is real simple. It's for Congress, particularly Democrats in Congress, to sit down with the president, do their jobs, and help us stop this awful crisis that's taking place at our border.
President Trump has come under sharp criticism for the sanctuary cities idea, including the charge that he intends to use immigrants as pawns in his battle with Democrats. That was echoed today by Democratic Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland. He was a guest on Fox News Sunday.
My understanding is it's not legal. There's no budget for that purpose. This is clearly a political move for the president. He's using the immigrants as pawns in his political game of chess.
A day after the Taliban announced the start of its annual spring offensive, a roadside bomb wounded four Romanian soldiers in southern Afghanistan. And fierce fighting between government forces and insurgents elsewhere in the country reportedly killed dozens. The spike in violence darkens the outlook for the U.S.-Taliban dialogue aimed at finding a political end to the 18-year-old Afghan war, along with a reduction in violence during this year's fighting season. A major early Sunday morning Taliban attack on the northern city of Kunduz sparked heavy combat with Afghan forces in the area, and there were casualties on both sides. This is VOA News. The next chapter in the extradition battle over WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange could involve competing claims from both the United States and Sweden, which wants him on charges of sexual misconduct. Assange's lawyer, Jennifer Robinson, says she does not want her client sent to the United States.
If Sweden makes an extradition request, there will be a question for the Home Secretary about which case will take precedence, and we will certainly be asking for the same assurances that we asked before, which is that he wouldn't be sent to the United States after dealing with it. That is the same assurance we were seeking in 2010, and the refusal to give that is why he sought asylum when
he did. So otherwise, he doesn't want to comply with it, unless there is that specific assurance?
The concern is and has always been about protecting him from being sent to the United States.
Dozens of members of the British Parliament have signed a letter urging the Home Secretary that if there are two extradition requests, that Assange be sent to Sweden. Assange was arrested on Thursday when British police took him from Ecuador's London embassy, where he had taken refuge nearly 7 years ago. Ecuador had given its go-ahead for the arrest on its grounds. Sudan has a change in leadership again, the third in less than a week, though these days each new leader wears a military uniform. This in the wake of the army's overthrow of Omar al-Bashir. Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder has a report.
Yet another army commander, promising victorious and jubilant protesters that there will be a civilian government to follow 3 decades of autocratic rule under Omar al-Bashir. Still, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan Abdel Rahman says the transition could take up to 2 years. And the crowds on Khartoum's streets are impatient for change and an end to rule by men in fatigues. Al-Bashir was arrested on Thursday after 4 months of protests over rising food prices, high unemployment and growing repression.
That was Lucy Fielder of Reuters. Prince Harry and Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, will soon be parents. Now it seems guessing the gender and name are all the rage in Britain. AP correspondent Zaria Shackley reports.
If Britain's bookmakers are to be believed, it's definitely a girl, and Diana may well be one of her many names. The William Hill agency closed the betting on the baby's gender a few days ago after an avalanche of bets poured in from people convinced the royal couple is having a girl. The secret's out as far as we are concerned, firm spokesman Rupert Adams said. While Adams acknowledged there is always a chance the surge was based on nothing, he said average betting patterns over the years suggest there's usually some truth in rumours. Zaria Shackley, London.
To stay up to date on all the day's news, we invite you online to voanews.com. You can also use the VOA News mobile app. Gene Randall, VOA News, Washington.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga.
We have spoken to refugees in detention centers who tell us that they can hear the clashes, and many are really scared. So we are advocating for release of all refugees and migrants from detention.
UN aid agencies call for the release of thousands of refugees and migrants ahead in Libya's detention centers near combat zones.
In terms of the pilots that we've looked at which ones can readily work based on existing infrastructure, existing studies, and that is why we will take it one tranche at a time.
African Union's Development Agency says plans are underway for a high-speed rail network connecting the continent's borders by the year 2063.
Number of people we are producing every year is faster than our development rates. And that's why Nigeria has now become the number one country with the highest number of poor people.
And Nigerian authorities offer free family planning methods and advice to Nigerian families in an effort to slow population growth. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Tens of thousands gathered at St. Peter's Square as Pope Francis celebrated Palm Sunday Mass. Palm Sunday marks the start of the holiest and one of the busiest times on the Pope's calendar. On the day, the church also celebrated the Day of the Youth. The Pope urged young people not to be ashamed to show their enthusiasm for Jesus. Sabina Castafranco has more for VOA.
As is tradition, Sunday Mass in St. Peter's Square on Palm Sunday began with Pope Francis sprinkling holy water and blessing palm fronds and olive branches for the service in front of the towering obelisk in the center of the square. The Vatican said over 40,000 people were present for the occasion. The Pope wore bright red vestments and held a braided palm as he and many cardinals and bishops took part in a long procession before he held Mass at an open-air altar in front of St. Peter's Basilica. Palm Sunday marks the day Jesus made his triumphant entry into Jerusalem.
Le acclamazioni dell'ingresso in Gerusalemme e l'umiliazione di Gesù.
Pope Francis began his homily by saying, "Joyful acclamations at Jesus' entrance into Jerusalem, followed by his humiliation, festive cries followed by brutal torture. This twofold mystery accompanies our entrance into Holy Week each year." The Pope said that it was important to resist the temptations of triumphalism and remain humble. He added, "One subtle form of triumphalism is spiritual worldliness, which represents the greatest danger, the most treacherous temptation facing the Church." The Pope said that Jesus destroyed his triumphalism by his passion. On Palm Sunday, the Pope also marks World Youth Day. The Pope called on young people not to be ashamed to show their enthusiasm for Jesus, but at the same time not to fear following him on the way to the cross. The Vatican has announced that the next World Youth Day will be held in Portugal in 2021. Pope Francis asked those gathered at the end of the Mass to pray for peace in the Holy Land and all of the Middle East. Like every year, the Pope has a busy schedule this week. On Holy Thursday, he will visit the prison of Velletri, south of Rome, where he will wash the feet of 12 prisoners. On Good Friday, he will lead the way of the cross procession at Rome's ancient Colosseum. And on Easter Sunday, the Pope will give his traditional blessing to the city and to the world. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
And in Sudan, the new leader of the Transition Military Council said Saturday he's committed transferring power to a civilian government within 2 years and that a night curfew had been cancelled. In his first televised address, Lieutenant General Abdullah Fattah Burhan also ordered the release of all prisoners jailed under emergency laws ordered by ousted President Omar al-Bashir. The moves are the latest indication that the pro-democracy demonstrations are weakening the military's influence. The announcements came after Sudanese intelligence chief Salah Abdallah Mohamed Saleh resigned Saturday, one day after the defense minister quit following the military's overthrow of the president. The protesters have said demonstrations would continue until a civilian transitional council is formed, fearing the military will rule indefinitely. The Sudanese Professionals Association, which has laid demands for a civilian government, called for more protests on Saturday. Al-Bashir's National Congress Party called on the council Saturday to release the former president, saying its overthrow of Al-Bashir was a power grab in violation of constitutional law. Meanwhile, Washington is urging Sudan's new leaders to hand over power to civilians in less than 2 years, and the European Union called for a swift transfer to civilian rule. UN aid agencies are urgently appealing for the release of thousands of refugees and migrants held in Libyan detention centers near combat zones where their lives are in peril. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Security in the Libyan capital Tripoli is worsening as fighting increasingly moves from the suburbs into the city center. The World Health Organization reports the number of war dead now has risen to 121, with nearly 600 wounded. WHO condemns repeated attacks on healthcare workers. It notes 8 ambulances have been struck since the renegade general began his march on Tripoli 11 days ago. The UN Refugee Agency reports more than 1,500 refugees are being held in official government detention centers in Tripoli. Spokesman Baba Balosh tells VOA there's great concern for the safety of the refugees and the many migrants who are being detained in areas where active conflict is ongoing.
We have spoken to refugees in detention centers who tell us that they can hear the clashes, and many are really scared. So we are advocating for release of all refugees and migrants from detention.
The UN Human Rights Office is calling for guarantees of protection of extremely vulnerable civilians, including refugees and migrants, many of whom are being held in horrific conditions. Human rights spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani tells VOA the inmates are under significant peril, as many may be caught in the crossfire.
Especially when armed groups involved in the conflict exercise influence or control over the detention facilities, these ad hoc detention facilities for migrants. Based on previous experience in Libya, we're also concerned that migrants may be used as human shields or forcefully recruited to fight as well.
The UN agencies are urging the Libyan authorities not to abandon the refugees and migrants in the prisons and detention centers. They are calling on all parties in this conflict to guarantee that detainees are treated humanely, in line with international law. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Along with massive protests, Algeria is also facing serious economic problems which have helped drive the current unrest. While the North African country is rich in oil and gas, it has failed to diversify its economy and unemployment is high. For VOA, Lisa Brandt takes a look at the challenges from Paris.
Another Friday, another mass protest in Algeria. Once again, thousands of people took to the streets calling for the country's leadership to go. Although there were reports of clashes and arrests this time, the largely peaceful demonstrations that began in February show Algerians want a complete overhaul of a political system that has been in place since independence. But the protests are also about the economy.
The economy is not in a very good shape, obviously.
Alexandre Kateb is a Paris-based analyst and served as an economic advisor for a recent former Algerian Prime Minister, Abdelmalek Sellal.
The protest is, as you might say, the last straw on the back of the camel. But the problems of the Algerian economy go much deeper than that, actually.
Algeria is rich in oil and gas. It supplies one-third of Europe's gas imports. But this strength is also a weakness. For years, the country used some of its hydrocarbon revenues to subsidize housing and other services, helping to reduce broader popular frustrations. That changed when world oil prices plummeted a few years ago. The country's leadership has not diversified the economy, and the private sector is weak. Today, roughly one-quarter of people under 25 are jobless, and Algeria has a large informal sector. Along with political freedoms, demonstrators want jobs. Algeria's new interim leader, Abdelkader Ben Salah, has set elections for July 4th. If they go ahead, says Algerian analyst Adel Hamaizia of London-based think tank Chatham House, the economy will be a central issue.
Whoever we pick as an Algerian population, I'm sure the main slogans are going to be centered around anti-corruption, economic justice, job creation, and employment.
The next leader also faces a daunting task.
Whoever comes in has to really lead an ambitious economic program which helps Algeria realize its potential and attract investment on the correct terms.
Whether the right candidate will emerge to fill those demands is uncertain. Many Algerians have little time for the current leadership or the traditional opposition parties. What's clear is the clock is ticking, and they have run out of patience with the status quo. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The African Union's Development Agency says plans are on track for a high-speed rail network connecting the continent's borders by 2063. The ambitious multi-billion dollar project aims at easing the movement of goods and people across African borders. But the AU warns that the brakes need to be put to corruption or else the project could be knocked off the rails, as Sarah Kimani reports for VOA from Nairobi.
Road, rail and air traffic connections are so poor between some African countries, it is better to transit through Europe than to travel directly between neighbors. But African Union experts meeting this week in Nairobi hope to change that. Intra-African trade is less than 15% of total trade, says head of infrastructure at the African Union's development agency, Adama Dean.
Now, you cannot have integration without connectivity, whether it's road connectivity or rail connectivity, particularly when we are talking about the Africa continental free trade area, where you need a single market, but within that context, you need connectivity to move goods and persons, you know, within the market.
During a two-day meeting in Nairobi, AU experts discussed linking all African capitals and commercial centers through a high-speed rail network by 2063. The African Integrated High-Speed Rail Network would aim to ease the movement of goods, people, and services across African borders by building on and improving existing national railways to link Africa's 54 countries, constructing at least 12,000 kilometers of new tracks. The multi-billion dollar project is on track, with 20% of the pilot phase to be completed in the next 4 years, says the technical committee's Cleopatra Chiseka Nshingila.
In terms of the pilots that we've looked at which ones can readily work based on existing infrastructure, existing studies, and that is why we will take it one tranche at a time. And that's why we think that we will have at least one project up and running.
Six corridors have been designated for connecting Africa by high-speed rail. Three of them include linking Kenya's Mombasa port city to Uganda's capital Kampala, South Africa's Durban to Botswana's Gaborone, and the Ivory Coast Abidjan to Burkina Faso's Ouagadougou.
May I have your attention, please? Attention, please.
In the past 5 years, Chinese loans have funded Kenya's first phase of the railway from Mombasa to Nairobi and from landlocked Ethiopia to Djibouti. But critics say Chinese loans are risking state assets and saddling African nations with heavy debts Beijing can use for political leverage. The CEO for the AU Development Agency in Kenya, Daniel Osiemo, says the continent should look to funding from within.
For example, look at the pension funds. All over the continent, we have pension funds which have been established, but which have not been channeled to productive investment. So if these are harnessed and put into this kind of investments, for sure, in a little time to come, they will be able to pay everyone. It will be a win-win for everyone.
But Osiemo says there are other challenges to meet the 2063 railway goal.
Then there are political challenges, you know. Central African Republic, our South Sudan, political instability. To work in such countries requires extra effort at the highest level in order to have these corridors facilitated and the links established.
AU High Representative for Infrastructure Development, former Kenyan Prime Minister Raila Odinga, worries corruption could be the project's biggest obstacle.
I'm going to give you an example. If you take the railway construction, you will go to Ethiopia, the rates are different. You go to Nigeria, they're different. You come to Kenya, you go to Tanzania, they're different. Yet you'll find that one of the same companies are doing them. That has a lot to do with the investment environment in those countries. And this is an enemy of Africa which must be fought.
How many of those battles are won will determine just how quickly Africa's first cross-continental high-speed train rolls out of the station. Sarah Kimani for VOA News in Nairobi, Kenya.
Malawi's opposition party, Tikonze People's Movement, TPM, says former Vice President Dr. Kassim Chilumba remains its presidential candidate for the upcoming May 21st general election. The TPM is a conglomerate of the so-called minor political parties, including Mafunde and the Assembly for Democracy and Development, ADD. The umbrella party's view became public after some members from the parties defected to Vice President Chilima's United Transformation Movement, UTM party, before the polls. Analysts say the umbrella party could play a meaningful role were it to form an alliance with the bigger opposition parties and therefore pose a threat to incumbent President Arthur Peter Mutharika's re-election bid. For reaction, my colleague Peter Klote reached Gambatula's Mose James, spokesperson for the Malawian opposition Tinkonze People's Movement, in the Malawian commercial capital of Blantyre.
The former Vice President, Dr. Kassim Chilumba, SEC, is our right candidate for the 21 May 2019, representing Tinkonze People's Movement Party.
There was a ruling which went against the former vice president, which effectively led to those rumors that he might be prevented from seeking the presidency of Malawi. Tell me about the circumstances leading to those speculations.
Of course, our party is not being sued, but the other group that has defected to UTM, United Transformation Party, are the ones that have sued Malawi Electoral Commission for allowing Dr. Kassim Chilumba to contest on this presidential election race.
Dr. Kassim Chilumba seemed to have lost this case. Is there any appeal, and what are the prospects that you're going to win? And is there time for you to be going to court to fight this when you have less time to campaign ahead of the May 21 elections?
Yes, of course we have more time, because what we know, we are doing a smart campaign. Our campaign is a very smart one. So we are doing it, and we have the reason to say we have more time. And again, on top of that, according to the ruling of the court, the High Court of Malawi, the High Court is the lower court, and then there is a Supreme Court of Appeal in Malawi here, and that Supreme Court of Appeal is where we are going to appeal this case, so that they should at least tell us what to do, because the lawyer for MEC and us, are going to appeal this case because that is the case belongs to Malawi Electoral Commission.
Well, Mr. Gambatula, some Malawians are saying your party is too small and that you might act as a detractor and allow incumbent President Arthur Peter Mutharika to win re-election because it would be beneficial if you would team up or form an alliance with an opposition party, perhaps Lazarus Chakwera's MCP, in order to have any meaningful impact in this upcoming election. What are your thoughts?
Of course, we are not a small party. We are the big party in Malawi here. We have large followers on the ground because people are on the ground. So we are not small. And we hope we are going to win because Dr. Kassim Chilumba, SEC, is a very experienced lawyer and he is a very experienced man that ran the country. Mind you, he was once a vice president of Malawi.
But some are saying his influence has waned since the time of being the vice president under Binguwa Mutharika, then served as a cabinet minister under Dr. Joyce Banda's party. So he basically doesn't have the political clout to challenge significantly in this coming elections. What do you say to that?
No. The thing is, we as Kikonza People's Party, led by Dr. Kassim Chirumba, SEC, an associate professor, we are hoping that we are going to win because we are in the race. And there is always, when you are in the race, you are supposed to tell your followers that you are going to win. And we are going to win because the followers are on the ground, as I've already said.
Dr. Kassim Chilumba met with Dr. Joyce Banda, UTM leader, Vice President Salos Chalima, and the rest. There were reports of a possible alliance dialogue between these individuals or political leaders in Malawi. What happened to it, and are there any chances of any political alliance in the run-up to the election?
No. Of course, we as Kikonze People's Party, led by Dr. Kassim Chilumba, SEC, we are not in any alliance with any party in Malawi here because those were rumors or speculations that we went to meet these people, but there was no any other memorandum of understanding that we have done that.
That was Gambatula Mose James, spokesman for the Malawian opposition Tikonze People's Movement, TPM. He spoke with my colleague Peter Klote from the Malawian commercial capital, Blantyre. With Nigeria's population growing at more than 3% a year, Nigerian authorities are offering free family planning methods and advice to Nigerian families in an effort to slow population growth. Nigeria, which already has the most people in Africa, is projected to have more than 400 million people by 2050. That's double the number today. For VOA, Timothy Obiezu has more from Abuja.
30-year-old Esther Ndubisi has 7 children. Her youngest child is only about 8 months old. She says her partner, a painter, barely makes enough to feed the family of 9 and cannot afford to send all their children to school.
To pay their school fees, sometimes self even bring problems between me and my husband.
Nigeria has the largest population in Africa and it is growing at 3.2% a year. The U.S. Census Bureau says at that rate, there will be an estimated 402 million people in Nigeria in 2050. The major triggers for population increase include early marriages, high birth rates, and lack of family planning access. But cultural and religious contributors are also impacting significantly. Family planning activists such as Ejike Oji worry about uncontrolled population growth.
Number of people we are producing every year is faster than our development rates. And that's why Nigeria has now become the number one country with the highest number of poor people.
But that could change. A project by the non-profit Planned Parenthood Federation of Nigeria is providing family planning methods and advice across the country. The non-profit is in collaboration with the Nigerian government on the project. Program officer Ada Iluno says it is making an impact.
When we go for outreaches, we seek out for rural areas where we know that the uptake is quite low and the need, your met need, is very high. Based on our operations, we've seen quite a lot of results where we see high turn-up of women.
The average family size in Nigeria is 5.6 people, but many families are larger, especially in the north, where polygamy is common. The government is trying to encourage smaller family sizes in order to secure Nigeria's financial future. But experts say until social structures like education and health are improved, the odds are that Nigeria's population will continue to increase and may even surpass the 2050 projection. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And see to come in the program, sports, then a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, and then our Saturday music spot from our collection of music from across the continent. But first, let's take a look at Nollywood. In terms of sheer output and profitability, Nigerian cinema, often called Nollywood, is the largest film industry in Africa and the second largest in the world. It has a powerful influence in how traditional gender roles are reinforced or new gender roles can be imagined on the continent. VOA's Adam Phillips filed this report on a recent mainstream release about a family that upends how women and men are usually depicted both within the family and in the culture.
That's the opening trailer music for God Calling. It's a faith-based drama in which a typical middle-class Nigerian family suffers a devastating loss, but is redeemed by the sudden prophetic powers of Shade, the main character, whom God contacts by mobile phone. God Calling tells the story of how she leads herself and her family members to spiritual redemption and a powerful new way to relate to each other and the world. During the film's recent promotional tour to the U.S., Zainab Balogun Wachuku, who plays the lead, said her character expresses both strength and resilience that are rarely seen in women in past Nollywood films.
In this story, my character is living her life on her own terms. She's leading the story, she's leading her home, and she's leading her family. And these are just angles that you don't really get to see.
Balogun Wachuku says this reflects an emerging trend in Nigeria overall.
I don't think that we would have been able to tell this kind of story in this environment if there weren't more women taking the risk, if there weren't more women who were stepping outside of the box. I think there's just a wave of so much independence and being able to do things without apologizing as African women, as Nigerian women.
As an example, she notes that women were also empowered during the making of the film itself.
These are camera women, these are gaffers, these are women doing what you would stereotypically think is a man's job. Then on the back end as well, as executive producers, you have women who are financing these projects, which shows that we're moving in the right direction. And I was fortunate to just be a part of that.
Co-executive producer Chukwuka Chukwuma takes Nollywood's cultural influence very seriously.
Absolutely. I mean, whether it's music, it's film, I think the whole media and entertainment industry is obviously a very good place to demonstrate women's strength, whether it's the heroine movies that we love, like Wonder Woman, or in our case, Black Panther. You've got the entire military looking strong and fierce. I mean, it's a totally different world. I have a daughter and I'm happier that she's going into a better world in terms of how we view women.
When women have the freedom to be strong, men can be freer to be tender and vulnerable, says Karabi Fubara, who plays Shade's husband, Francis. In his experience, having to play it tough and be in charge all the time is both burdensome and unnecessary.
And I think we took a lot of that out of this film to just show that there is a masculinity that has a balance, masculinity that is affectionate and caring and loving and wants the best for his family. If that means his wife has to be in the forefront, then that's what it means. So I think this is going to push the needle in terms of that.
Fubara told VOA that God Calling may even have changed some minds on set. While shooting some particularly emotional scenes, he would sometimes see young male crew members wipe away tears. That's one indication that gender equality isn't just good for Africa and the world, it could also be divine for business. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And now, sports fans, on to Nightline Africa Sports. In the African Champions League, TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo survived an early scare to beat Tanzania's Simba 4-1 and become the first team to reach this season's Africa Champions League semi-finals. South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns booked their place too in the last four with a 5-1 aggregate win over Al Ahly despite losing the second leg of their quarter-final 1-0 in Egypt. Holders Esperance of Tunisia beat Algeria's CAS Constantine 3-1 in Tunisia. Later on Saturday, record 8-time former winners Al Ahly of Egypt beat Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa 1-0 in Alexandria, but was not enough for the Egyptian giants to overturn their 5-0 mauling by Sundowns in the first leg last weekend. Meanwhile, the Africa Cup of Nations 2019 draw took place in Giza. Host Egypt will face DR Congo, Uganda and Zimbabwe in Group A. Defending champions Cameroon are in Group F with Ghana, Benin and Guinea-Bissau. The tournament will take place from June 21st to July 19th, meaning Europe-based players will not miss club games. It's the biggest Africa Cup of Nations yet with 24 teams and the first to be held in Europe's summer rather than January or February. Morocco, the Atlas Lions, are in Group D with the Ivory Coast, South Africa and neighbouring Namibia complete that group. The first game of the tournament will be Egypt, who are likely to have Liverpool star Mohamed Salah in their team, against Zimbabwe on June 21st at Cairo Stadium. Two of the three tournament's debutants, Madagascar and Burundi, are in Group B with Nigeria and Guinea. The other new team, Mauritania, are in Group E with Tunisia, Mali and Angola. Senegal and Algeria alongside Kenya and Tanzania, who have only qualified once before in 1980 in Group C. Two teams from each group will go into the last 16 with the four best third place teams also progressing. In another development, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, has appointed Moroccan Hajj Maoud as its new general secretary. He replaces Egyptian Amri Fahmy, who was dismissed from the position over a week ago. CAF's executive committee made its decision in Cairo on Thursday ahead of the draw for the 2019 Africa Cup of Nations. Finally, in the marathons, Regasa Mindai of Ethiopia and Sheila Jerotich of Kenya took impressive victories at the 7th edition of the Olen Wasso Marathon on Sunday. Mindai prevailed in the sprint finish against Kenyan Ezekiel Omulo to take victory in 2:09.42. while Jerotich set a new course record of 2:26.06 of a minute and a half ahead of fellow Kenyan Antonina Kwambai. Mindai eventually pulled away to finish 7 seconds ahead of Omulo. Mindai's winning time was a new personal best for the Ethiopian, who sliced more than a minute from his two-year-old mark of 2:10.51. Another Ethiopian, Wekunesh Sayom, held on for third, exactly 1 minute behind the winner. Further back, Chaoboske finished fourth in 2:13.10. In the women's race, a lead group of five emerged earlier on, composed of Kenyan Jerotich Kwambai and Gladys Yatro, and Ethiopians Fantu Zaude Jifar and Hemele Wotesa. The leaders built more than a minute's lead by the halfway point. Jerotich pulled away shortly before the 35-kilometer mark and eventually finished in 2:26.06. 19 seconds under the old mark set by Fatuma Sado in 2015. Kwambai came second in a time of 2:27.43 in her marathon debut. Nina Savino of Belarus came third, and Victoria Kalzahan of Ukraine was fourth. In China, Kenya's Andrew Ben Kimutai registered a convincing victory as he broke the course record at the Dongfeng Renault Wuhan Marathon on Sunday. The 29-year-old Kimutai built a comfortable lead after 28 kilometers and crossed the line in 2:10.06. It was Kimutai's first victory in four races in China, and he made his second fastest time. Belachou Alemayu of Ethiopia came second, and the 39-year-old Edwin Chirwa, also of Kenya, took the third place in 2:11.26. Unlike the lopsided men's race, the women's race was only decided after the 40th kilometer mark. Pre-race favorite Fantu Jima of Ethiopia emerged victorious from a four-women battle to notch the win in 2:28.25. fellow Ethiopian, 25-year-old Tesh Sehai Maru, was 24 seconds behind Jima to finish second, and Kenyan Tekla Kirongo finished third. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sport. It's Sunday here on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent.
Jiko langu kama mboni ya macho yangu, kulinda the mpenzi wangu Weni jiko, we jiko langu kama boni ya macho yangu Nita kulinda mpenzi wangu Achana nao, achana nao Uachana nao Awa wenye roho mbaya, wana tusema vibaya Achana nao, achana nao Uachana nao Awa wenye roho mbaya, wana tusema vibaya Baby love Wewe wangu mi wako wa moyo Oh baby love Sije necha kwa fitna na maneno yao Baby love Wewe wangu mi wako wa moyo Oh baby love Sije necha kwa fitna na maneno yao
And that was our Sunday music spot on Nightline Africa from the English service of The Voice of America. Now, let's take a closer look at Africa. One man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Take it away, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. How long will African states endure the application of double standards by the international community that may be pernicious to the welfare? Of course, it has been established that powerful and wealthy states believe firmly that they have a right to apply double standards, particularly on states that have inordinate dependence on their largesse. What happened in the ICC last week is a clear indication of the double standards. The chief prosecutor perhaps trying to demonstrate that the ICC was not focusing only on the African continent, but also casting a wider net, sought permission from the court to start investigation of war crimes in Afghanistan. The court gave a very strange ruling. It stated that there were no sufficient information to commence such investigation, which means case closed. This ruling by the court should be seen in a wider context. Few weeks ago, Secretary of State Pompeo laid down the law towards the ICC as perceived by the United States. He asserted that the United States could not tolerate any ICC investigation of its military forces in the war in Kabul, and would not allow that also in Iraq, he went on to state that the U.S. would not target also any investigation of its major allies, and here defense was made to Israel, of investigation of its military forces in the Middle East and referring to Yemen, implied also for Saudi Arabia. And it stated, if the ICC did not honor these cautions, the U.S. will apply penalties on the officers of the ICC. And when the chief prosecutor decided to approach the ICC on Afghanistan, the Secretary of State revoked the visa of the chief prosecutor and also left open the possibility that the judges of the ICC may also come under the same penalty. So this is the way some may fairly interpret the curious ruling of the ICC. It has also been the view of this commentator over the years that one of the reasons why the ICC has focused on Africa is because Africa is a weak and powerless state and could not push back. And we have seen already two instances and two heads of states, Omar Bashir of Sudan, Kenyan President Kenyatta, that dragged before the ICC. And after this ruling by the court, just few days or hours, we heard that the Military Ruling Council had deposed President Omar al-Bashir and had put him under house arrest, and that he may be detained in Sudan. Suddenly, those human rights NGOs that have been silent in reacting to the laws laid down by Secretary of State Pompeo and the U.S., found their voices, and we are demanding that former President Bashir be brought before the ICC. Of course, the ruling council said that Mr. Bashir will not be sent to the ICC, that he would be tried in Khartoum. So this is the situation we find ourselves with double standards. The United States and some members of the Security Council will not accept the jurisdiction of the ICC, but they feel free to send cases from the Security Council to the ICC, even those doing that do not recognize the jurisdiction of the ICC. And this is the dilemma that Africans face. Could they continue to tolerate it? And this, in my view, is what the African Union should deal with. Why can't we see the outrage by the international NGOs who talk about immunity when one is told that you cannot conduct investigation for war crimes in Iraq, in Middle East, but you can in Africa? I thank you.
That was one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From all of us here at Nightline Africa, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Producer Saida Hamdon, I'm Douglas Impuga, wishing you a very good evening.
This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall in Washington.